Hi, and welcome back to Forest of the Future. This episode is part of a three-part miniseries exploring how climate change is being addressed within FSC, with a starting point in FSC Canada and their work. In the first episode of this series, we explored why climate change requires us to rethink forest management and why adapting our practices is becoming essential for both forests and the people who depend on them. Across the miniseries, we will take a closer look at how FSC Canada is currently working on concrete initiatives to both integrate climate adaption into Canadian forest management standards and to develop practical tools to support forest owners and managers in responding to climate risks. In this episode, we move from framing the challenge to looking into those practical tools. Climate change is often described as uncertain and complex, but forest managers still need to make decisions today. One tool increasingly used to support climate adaption is the Climate Vulnerability Assessment, or CVA for short. FSC Canada has identified CVA as a very promising way to support forest managers and certificate holders in accounting for and preparing for climate change. In this episode, we will explore what a climate vulnerability assessment is, how it's being used in forest management, and what that looks like in practice. We will be drawing on a case study from Mystic Management. To guide us through this conversation, I am joined by Dr. Sherry Andrews-Keys from the University of British Columbia, the Faculty of Forest and Environmental Standards, and by Kevin Gillis from Mystic Management. And both of them bring extensive experience on working with climate vulnerability assessments in the forestry sector. So why don't we just dive straight in? Hi, Sherry. Welcome to the podcast. To start us off, can you tell us what is climate vulnerability assessments and why has that become such an important tool for climate change adaption in forestry today?
In a nutshell, I would say that climate vulnerability assessments are a tool to be able to allow us in different sectors, communities, et cetera, whatever context we're working in, to take a look at our actual system and our land base, what we're managing. We can scale it to whatever context we and temporal and geographical size we wish to assess. It's a tool that allows us to look at the biophysical aspects of climate change. So what's happening in temperature, precipitation, what's happening in changing weather patterns, looking at historical climate data and different events that we've had happening on the landscape out there in the natural systems, and looking at how our natural systems are being affected by changes that are happening in weather and climate over, you know, different timescales. And then through that, it allows us to look at the type of management system, the human parts of the system that we're working in, because we can't look at one without the other if we're actually going to move to true adaptation. And it allows us to look at both parts of those of our systems and look at what is working well, where are we finding challenges, how are things happening on the ground and in the environment affecting the management and practices that we're trying to do out there and things we're trying to achieve for biodiversity and different forest practices. And it allows us to hone in on those priority areas. It allows us to get a better idea of what is actually feasible for us to adapt to and how can we be more proactive instead of reactive in our planning. So in a nutshell, in the climate vulnerability assessments that I've had the pleasure to be a part of and in the frameworks and the theory that I work in, these have proven to be really great tools to be able to help build capacity across different sectors for land users, communities, etc., and bring together a diversity of stakeholders and owners and people involved in those landscapes and those systems to help create more co-management and build capacity across the board for these people to be able to respond to what's happening out there, the environment. It's not perfect. It's not a crystal ball. But what it does is it helps us deal with the uncertainty that we continue to face and this increasing uncertainty around different shifts that we're seeing within weather and climate. If you want to take a deeper dive into it, the main climate vulnerability assessment framework that I work from is the Canadian Council of Forest Ministers guidebook, looking at climate vulnerability and mainstreaming. And it's a conceptual framework. It's a process. And it has different stages in there. And as you work through the stages, it helps break things down into manageable chunks for your organization or community to be able to start to get a clearer picture, setting the context, setting those foundational pieces for moving forward to better build adaptation. You don't just jump to adaptation for the sake of adaptation. You have to really sit down and work with your team, like Kevin and I have done since we started working together in 2015, and say, okay, what are we actually going to assess here? What's the physical scope that we're going to look at? What parts of our management system do we want to look at? And make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of how we're thinking about defining adaptive capacity, defining climate vulnerability, defining adaptation, because there are varying definitions out there, defining resilience and what that means to that specific team that's working on this. The first step is really sitting down, designing your team, and setting the context, setting those foundational pieces. And then you continue to build on it with different forms of knowledge, and that includes well beyond Western science. So, you know, we use climate data, we use the research and that out there, but there is no substitute, and Kevin can attest to this, for what the land users and those different folks on the land base, their experience, their knowledge, their understanding, and what they've been seeing. So that is included in there. And that's a huge part of how you move forward in this and really identify where are our challenges? Where are we seeing these vulnerabilities and risks? And then thinking, how are we already making changes? How have we already been adapting to this? And where do we want to go with adaptation as we move forward? And how are we going to implement and mainstream this? That's kind of the process in a nutshell.
Okay. I know that FSC US have been successful in adding climate vulnerability mechanisms into their recently approved National Forest Management Standards. How are these vulnerability assessments being used in forest management in Canada? And are you one of the ones driving their adoption, or who's leading that push towards adoption of them?
Well, I've had the pleasure of being part of this type of work since 1999. My mentor, Dr. Mark Johnson, he was one of the key people in the Canadian context pushing this kind of work forward in climate change and forest management in the Canadian context. I've been working in this and at different scales over that time, but really, in March 2015, the Canadian Council of Forest Ministers brought out the guidebook with this framework for the CCFM framework on climate change vulnerability. And we were asked to test this. Mark and I were asked to test this in an industry context. And we were both in Saskatchewan at the time, and we have a history with Mystic. Mystic is well known for being very innovative in its, you know, ideas and open-mindedness and thinking. And we approached Mystic to see if they'd be willing to go on this journey with us. And we didn't know where it was going to take us. And we started that with Mystic and with Kevin and Roger Nesdoli, who is the former GM of Mystic at the time. So Mystic, from an industry perspective, has been a lead, not just in Canada, but even in a North American context. Mystic has been recognized and even globally for a lot of the work we've done here, and has continued to evolve and work on this since 2015. And from there, other forest companies such as Canfor, West Fraser, Dunkley, BC government, BC timber sales, organizations across Canada have started to do this kind of work. Currently doing this with ALPAC in British Columbia, and doing this with Nova Scotia government in cooperation with the Family Forest Network and private woodlot owners. So this has really expanded since 2015. A good portion of forest companies across specifically BC, Alberta, and Saskatchewan, Manitoba have all worked with me to build this into their systems. Weyerhaeuser, we're continuing to build on work that we started in 2018. So it's not just a one and done. It's being embedded in what we do as business out there on the ground.
I can't help but think that 2015 is, at least I'm from Europe, so I come at this from a European context. In 2015, I don't think or know of anybody who is doing climate adaptation and climate assessments in that sense. Was it pretty early on that, like, you must almost have been first movers in this?
I would say, Kim, from an industry perspective especially, yeah, we were. You know, it was overwhelming. They were looking at things like the guidebook that came out, which the idea behind the CCFM framework was that it was, you were supposed to be able to take it, that Kevin or anybody that worked for Mystic could just take this and do this as a project off the side of their desk and build it out. We were a pretty diligent team, and it took us 3 years to build this out. But, you know, we were kind of working from scratch and figuring this all out, because there were bits and pieces out there. There were, you know, things from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, sort of at a, you know, more community level, where vulnerability assessments had been done, but really nothing so applied. And so just really trying to look at how can we make this something that's going to be of value and really tailor it and benefit to our system. But the framework allowed us to be able to do that. And we've refined it a lot since. We've learned a lot of things, and we're still at it.
Okay. So it sounds like now it's also maybe more implementable.
I would say that there's more examples out there. There's more experience. So in that, it makes it more implementable. And in a lot of ways, we've learned how I've streamlined the process as we've worked through this. So recognizing what do we really need to focus on here, and then the extra pieces we can build on as we move forward, if that's something that's applicable to the organization.
Okay. I'd like to make this a bit more tangible for people like me who's not actually a forester. Can you take us through some of the key steps that are involved in a typical assessment? What do you do to do the assessment?
There are four main phases that you work through. And as I mentioned earlier, in the beginning, it's more of what we call organizational readiness. So this is where we set the stage, we set the context, we develop our team, who's going to be part of this team, we set the timelines, sort of like building in terms of reference for the team, for the process, just like forest companies do when they're doing, would you say, Kevin, your 20-year forest management plan renewal. You set that stage, that context. And then it's gathering of the relevant local knowledge, what they're actually seeing, what they're experiencing on the landscape, looking at what impacts they're already experiencing from climate change with respect to their business. We actually look at non-climatic factors that are affecting how they're managing what they're doing, their practice, and then how potentially climate and things happening out there and weather can affect those non-climatic factors. So things like cumulative impacts. And then we move forward to looking at the details of their management system. So what are they legally required to achieve in terms of for the province? Because forest companies in the Canadian context, they have to adhere to the regulatory requirements within each province. In Saskatchewan specifically, for Mystic, they have what we call VOITs, their values, objectives, indicators, and targets. And we go through and we look at those and say, okay, how are we achieving these under this climate weather lens? Are things being impacted? To what degree do we feel that they're being impacted? How do we feel currently we're managing this? Do we feel that we have adequate tools, training, et cetera, financial resources to be able to achieve this? And then we actually look at, well, where is our vulnerability and risk related to climate change around this? So, for example, Saskatchewan went through an extremely risky fire season this past summer. It had some devastating impacts to a lot of the forest within northern Saskatchewan. And this did impact Mystic and their management. Looking at things like that, does fire have a risk? Does changing temperature have a risk? And assessing that based on their experience and knowledge. And then after we go through all of their parts of their management system and assessing those, we also look at the adaptive capacity of the organization. So we look at things like the policy and regulatory framework they're in, look at things like their certification, where are some challenges, where are some alignments, where are some pinch points going to be. So looking at these two things, then we can better get a picture of where do we need to focus our priorities on? Where are we going to have the most challenges? What do we actually have control over? Because there's lots of things that are at risk out there and vulnerable under that climate lens that at the end of the day, we have no control over as land managers. Really acknowledging that and then saying, okay, these are the priority areas. This is what we have capacity to do. These are things that are feasible. What are we going to do for adaptation? So we unpack that and look at what are we already doing? And then how are we going to continue to build on this? And we explore different adaptation tactics that are out there that are available to forest managers. And then we set those priorities and figure out how we're going to implement them using tools that we already have within the existing system. So an example of that could be using existing standard operating procedures and building those in, operating procedures around roads, operating procedures around high-value conservation areas, the biodiversity pieces. Depending on what our priority areas are, we look at different things within our system, tools that we already have, and how we can build them to be more proactive and build in our adaptations. Then once we decide on the adaptation, and we want to make sure that it's not going to put something else at risk. So that's called a maladaptation. So we want to make sure we really understand that, okay, this is not going to cause us problems in other areas and will benefit us, or we think it's going to benefit us here. And then we develop an implementation and monitoring plan. And we figure out how we're going to continue to report on this, how we're going to monitor it. Because at the end of the day, if you don't have that, you might as well not necessarily do adaptation to a certain degree, because how do you know it's actually achieving what you need it to achieve? We need to build in that monitoring. It's such a key piece. Because then when we come back and we say, okay, is this actually achieving what we want it to achieve? Yes, great. Let's continue to move forward. Or we need to tweak it here and there. Or no, this is not working. We need to look at something else. It's not a one and done. It's this cycle, right? And we continue to learn and we understand that we're working in very dynamic systems out there. So we have to have flexible and robust measures and monitoring and implementation set up so that we continue to be more proactive than reactive.
It sounds a lot, Kevin. I'd love to bring you in and pivot to the case of Mystic Management and give you a chance to speak as well. Because it sounds like you've been part of this from the outset, which is, you must have gone through a couple of rounds at least by now, I'm assuming, since this is a cyclical process. Can you tell us, like, we heard that fire is one of the risks that you identified now. What were some of the key other vulnerabilities that emerged from your process?
I would say that a fire is a natural disturbance. All natural disturbances have the potential for increased risk. Most importantly, wildfire risk is one of our top priorities, if not the top priority, but also events such as large blowdown events, insect and disease, snow press, if you're familiar with the weight of snow breaking branches, and also ice storm damage from winter storms, which we don't normally have, buildup of ice on tree limbs and stems, you know, snapping trees off, damaging wood fiber kind of thing. The second most important item I would say that would be the climatic and seasonal variabilities that comes with temperature variability. And these cause us operational delays, right? Things such as late freeze-up periods kind of thing. So not normal winter freeze-up times. And just the overall shorter winter season, which is the season where we focus most of our activities. Logging is most efficient in winter. And another thing that causes issues are with those temperature fluctuations, roads and highways. There are temperature restrictions associated with that, and that causes us not to be able to haul winter weights. And we have to call program weights kind of thing. So it limits our capacity to be able to do those things in winter while winter is occurring. The third item would be forest productivity. So growth and regeneration success and the effects of the changing weather patterns, extreme weather events that we're experiencing, and those effects on our annual allowable cut. So that's how much we can harvest in a year on our land base. So we have 1.9 million hectares of land, and we have an annual allowable cut associated with that number. We're potentially looking at effects from climate that will impact that number going forward.
And what do you then do? Like, now you have a long list of this is all of the things that could go wrong or likely will go wrong due to climate change. What are the changes that you can make to actually address those risks?
Sure. So for each one of these, as you know, through the vulnerability assessment, it actually allows you to write your own prescription for each one of these vulnerabilities that we have. So something like natural disturbance / wildfire, we're adapting and practicing guidelines that were developed by the provincial government as opposed to forest operations and the daily wildfire risk rating system that they have developed. And that is whether the risk is low, moderate, high, or extreme. We have operational requirements in and around each one of those categories. We're requiring equipment to be operated within specific periods or not operating at all due to the risk factors associated with it. Mitigating the climate and seasonal variability. So there's changes in operational practices, such as doing things like pre-developing our summer roads that are quite often at risk for being large rain events. So you have a lot of moisture associated with that as you're trying to access your timber fiber in year one. And so rather than trying to build road and harvest in the same area at the same time, We're pre-building the roads a year ahead of time, so there's no pressure on that road system when you do have those climatic weather events. So we can build those roads and leave them intact and allow them to set up properly so we can use them the next year. So we're not forcing the issue to try to, you know, keep people working and working against our better judgment. We're doing things like developing permanent stockpile sites so we can move wood from the forest to a staging area where that wood can stay in that staging area until we need it. And if we're affected by weather, that it's close to a highway where we can haul that fiber to the mills, even in a weather adverse times throughout the year kind of thing. If you got 3 days of rain, it shuts down your log haul from the forest, from the harvest block, but you can use your stockpile site. And then having those long-term stockpiles, which is something that's fairly new for us. Over the last couple of years, we realized that having permanent stockpile sites to ensure that steady flow of fiber to the mill is happening, and they're more comfortable with the delivery schedule. We're not running the mills out of wood.
How many of these things do you think you would have done anyway without a climate vulnerability assessment, and how much of this has made you more proactive?
We are probably ahead of the game because we started thinking about climate change and our vulnerabilities as far back as 2006. And Dr. Mark Johnson was the professor that actually started to develop that with us. So we've been thinking about it for a really long time and realizing that we have specific duties to the mills to ensure that fiber is going to get there. And ignoring climate would be a mistake and has been a mistake in the past. A really large event happened in 1999, which wasn't on our FMA, which got the attention of our parent mills, our ownership. And they wanted to be in a place where they would be able to adapt to the changing climate and moving forward.
Okay. So it sounds like you were ahead of the game, but this is doing it in this framework. Do you think it gives you a better ability to foresee and plan ahead than if you hadn't done it, if you hadn't used this framework?
Absolutely. I think that the investment that was made by the federal government in developing the CCVA was ahead of its time. And having that template to be able to, you know, sometimes you don't think of everything, but it was very well thought out in the stage process where you measure whether you're ready to do it or not. You look at your weaknesses, you look at what you can't change, you look at what you can change, and then you implement the changes that you feel that would best benefit the mills and the forest.
Yeah, I guess also having that whole framework, that some of the things you can't change them, but at least you have a process for what you then do would also be helpful. Otherwise, it's just a glooming.
Yep.
Chaos.
The framework itself would allow you to measure that against the low, medium, and high risk. So you pigeonhole the specific indicators that fit your profile.
I wanted to mention that, yeah, forest managers are really good at adaptation. They adapt all the time. That's what we do out there on the land base. But the framework, what it allows is a more formalized way of capturing this. It also helps capture knowledge and things that are happening that can be used as a training tool for new practitioners coming in on the job. It's also a really good way of having that internal information and practice captured for the organization itself so that it can continue to learn from it and give those baseline data pieces and information. Because a lot of times the literature, the academic research and things out there doesn't really capture a lot of the things that happen at the local level and especially the applied context. So there's a big gap there and we're missing that. And so by doing this too, what it allowed Roger, Kevin and I to do was to take some key pieces to the provincial government, to Forest Services, and have conversations with them about this is what the regs say, but this is not how it's going to be able to be sustainable in practice and reality on the ground with what we're dealing with. So it gives another tool to be able to advocate for practice, for a more flexible and robust policy and things too.
So it actually becomes a two-way street, and also learning the other way from the bottom up. That's really interesting. I'm actually wondering about the intersection between this, which was a government-led tool development, and a system like FSC. I know, Sherry, that you've been involved in many of these different processes in many different contexts. How do you see that intersection? Does an FSC forest management certification or forest management standards as such, does that help set people up for success in terms of if they're certified, they're more able to adopt vulnerability assessments and climate considerations and are better able to embed them in their current approaches? Or is there any hindrance there because it's two different frameworks that would then almost have to merge?
Actually, I'm going to let Kevin take this one first.
Okay.
Because Kevin has worked and he has been in FSC a lot longer than I have. And I think can speak better to that than I can at this point.
Well, take it away, Kevin.
Sure. So I guess the issue with federal, provincial, FSC standards kind of thing, the way I see it is that although the CCVA was written by federal government and it's highly applicable to us as forest managers, it wasn't specifically written for just for forestry. But FSC has always been the leading certification when it comes to innovation and acceptance and ensuring that the land and the forests are treated in a way that is sustainable moving forward. With that, I think that FSC has always been a leader in looking at the best possible solutions. And with the changes that have happened in the last decade with climate research, it's time to get that written into the standard. Most of these, I guess, the indicators that Mystic has been using already exist. It's just that I think that we need to ensure that these adaptations in and around the indicators are going to be shopped around across the country and across the world, giving options for land managers and forest managers, certificate holders, to ensure that they're able to meet the needs of their specific land base, but also are going to be following a template that would be able to be auditable and measured against one another.
So you're actually calling for this to be implemented into the Canadian Forest Management Standards.
Yeah, and I've seen this actually in other certification as well, and it's been a great tool for, you know, addressing requirements in other forest certifications and that. But the one thing that it's exciting to see how FSC has approached this process, because working with Mystic, so part of what we're doing is a case study to be able to provide that real on the ground applied practice and what we've done, how we've continued to build on it to certificate holders for FSC as they're moving forward in navigating, building this in and this process to part of the certification requirements in the Canadian context. Another thing I think is really exciting is that FSC US has already approved it, and the framework and the group that they've worked with under NIACS, I've worked with that group as well. Their framework, we've compared and contrasted the Canadian framework, CCFM, and the US frameworks. They all come from the same theory. They're all developed with the same pieces. So it's going to align so well with that. And I think the way that the process is going, before it's even required, you're really building the capacity of existing certificate holders by taking this type of process, you know, with Kevin being involved and, you know, sharing the wealth of experience and knowledge that Mystic has in this space and moving on. And other FSC groups have already started this, such as ALPAC, without it even being a requirement. So I think that that's really positive.
Yes. And one might then say, well, if forest managers are already picking this up voluntarily, does it need to be in the FSC standard? What is the benefit of it being in the FSC standard?
I'll speak to that. I would say that it might not be in the standard, but I think that the measurability is really important. Consistency across the land base, where there are growing expectations in and around climate change and actions that forest managers take due to changing conditions. And the impacts are different now than they were 20 years ago on things like soil and water and species at risk. So I think it's really important that we get this on into the standards to ensure that none of those three things suffer.
Scaling that up, there's a lot more, I guess, desire to see this built out in ways to meet corporate reporting requirements for mm-hmm. environmental, social, and governance reporting, for TCFD reporting, which is Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Accounting. If you have a board that you're reporting to, other stakeholders on the land base, communities, indigenous groups working with forest companies, they want people to be accountable. And I think that this is a great vehicle for providing that extra layer of accountability. So I think that that also adds to what Kevin was mentioning from the industry perspective.
Now you mentioned communities and indigenous groups. One of the things you also mentioned as part of the steps was getting more knowledge from the ground. Is this also a way to get more involvement from the ground and to actually bring more people into your planning and your assessment going forward? Like, does it lead to better outcomes that you have this process of structured engagement than a normal FSC certification would typically do, for example?
I think there's the potential for that going forward. So we've had a system in place that's worked very well for us for a really long period of time, for more than 20 years. We have a public advisory group. That group actually encompasses academia, government, indigenous peoples, all forest users, municipal partners, so pretty much everyone. And we've involved that group of people right from the very start, so that we've got feedback from them prior to us implementing our vulnerability assessment and gathering information from communities along the way. Use community members, especially in the far reaches of our FMA, for information, historical context. People are really concerned about climate and how things are changing and fluctuations in water and seasonal migrations of wildlife. The people on the ground are really important in providing information on that, and they feel more engaged when they're allowed to participate in a setting like that, and they're seeing the results come the end in our annual report and our reportable items.
So it actually makes them engage more than if you hadn't done it, do you think?
I think so. I think the system it speaks for itself, but specifically for climate change, there wasn't a template for that prior to this, but now we have that. They see the results, and some of the results come directly from them. So they feel extremely engaged when they're seeing those results that they reported on.
And is this something, because now your case is a very specific one, you were one of the front runners, sure, is this a tendency that you're seeing across the many different contexts you've been part of? Does it lead to better community engagement?
Yes. Mystic is, in a lot of ways, very unique. I have never worked with another organization across Canada that has such a strong public advisory group and process for engagement as Mystic has. There's a long history of them engaging with and working through, you know, conflict and challenging situations with other land users and owners on the landscape. A lot of forest companies that I've continued to work with don't have that strength in their public engagement and relationship and trust built with other stakeholders. So we are working harder with using this framework as a vehicle to help improve that, to help build that trust, to help engage public and communities in the process. So I think that it does provide a good tool for that. Some of the work that I've done across Canada, one of the biggest things that organizations have recognized on the human side of things, what we call social dimensions, is their weakness or vulnerability around public acceptance and social license in this space, and recognizing that this is something they need to build capacity in. And using the climate vulnerability assessment and looking at how they want to move forward with it, some of the things that have been identified is, you know, more co-collaboration on different types of projects that are doing adaptation and things that help not only the company or the industry side of things and the land base, but also help the communities that are around or within it.
I can't help but think that, and maybe it's just my cynical nature, we do a lot of these assessments. We do a lot of CSR reporting, compliance reporting, et cetera. And one of the things that we often see, just like with strategies and other change management processes, is that we spend a lot of time in developing it, getting information, involving the entire organization, our community, et cetera. And we build this lovely piece of paper, and then we put it on a shelf or put it in a drawer, and it never really gets implemented in praxis. How do you ensure that it actually leads to change on the ground and isn't just this giant exercise? We get a lot of information and do beautiful plans, but you never really implement. Sherry, I'm thinking maybe you can give your context, and then Kevin, I'd like to ask very specifically afterwards to you in terms of how, for example, the wildfire last season has led to the GIA assessment, whether it has actually led to specific changes. But Sherry, I'm thinking if we look at it from the framework context, how do you ensure it doesn't just sit on the shelf?
A lot of times it's the way that you do it. You can take this framework and work through it any way that you wish, really. But if you really want it to be effective and you want it to be of value to your organization, there has to be that buy-in at that level for the people who are going to implement this. And the way that the process is set up and I work through it with folks is they have to, I facilitate and help guide them through it, but it's theirs. They make it theirs. The framework is set up to allow that to happen. It's flexible. So there's no one size that fits all. Each forest company, even in Saskatchewan that I work with, and two of them share a forest management agreement area, and they both have different priorities within their vulnerability assessment. And I work with both Weyerhaeuser and Edgewood Forest Products on this, and they both go through the same process, but they have different parts of their system that they build this into, different ways of how they want to report on it and engage people. I think, first of all, the framework is tailorable. Mm-hmm. If you own it, and you make it part of your system, you break it down to manageable pieces, because often if these things are done by an outsider and you get a fancy report at the end of it, you haven't owned it. You haven't walked through the process. You haven't really informed it at that local level with all those key pieces that are relevant to your business, to your practice. And it's not gonna, you're wasting your money. It's not a value to sit on the shelf. We break down your management system and build it into the different pieces. And I think that's one of the key things, that you have to actually embed it into what you do. It becomes your part of your business as usual. This is what we do. This is how we report on it. This is how we're mainstreaming it into our existing system. So in terms of making it relevant, it's got to be relevant. It's got to be applicable. And it's, where is the value? What's the value proposition of this? It's really too thinking about what is our core business and what are the key things that we need to consider here as we're developing this, and where do we need to embed it?
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's where it's also, or at least from where I said, it might be an advantage is to be certified, because you do have those standard operating procedures, and you're used to actually working with procedures and implementing procedures and having those audited. I'm wondering, Kevin, whether it's possible to make this a bit more tangible than it being a framework and a process and something that you reiterate. We learned that you had one of the biggest wildfire seasons in recent history. Can you speak to some of the ways that having been engaged in this whole vulnerability assessment process set you up to better cope with events like that?
So the vulnerability assessment, the way we feel about it is that it's an investment in identifying our priority issues. And our priority issues, as I had mentioned earlier, number one was natural disturbance and wildfire. So if it's truly number one, there needs to be an investment, as I had mentioned. So it's a human investment and also at times needs to be a financial investment as well. So in order to deal with wildfire and issues that we're having with natural disturbance, that we need to invest sometimes in things like equipment. Maybe a forest management company needs to invest, although it might be a provincial responsibility for firefighting, this certificate holder would have obligations as well. So we've made close to a $100,000 investment in forest fire fighting equipment. So that's things like pumps and sprinklers and hoses and water cannons kind of thing to protect our assets and the forest as a whole. So it's priority number one. And sometimes you got to sell it, right, in order to get the appropriate amount of budget money to be able to do something within your vulnerability assessment. And that's been recognized by our board of directors and our management that is definitely a priority. And sometimes we're the first ones that could be at a fire or action it as quickly as possible. Without those assets, it would be really hard to say that it's a priority. We're making that investment with people and resources as well. We're really good at measuring things in forestry. We have an entire volume of an annual report that we look after kind of thing. And a lot of these items within that annual report are tactics that we've developed. We have a daily spreadsheet and we're measuring that spreadsheet against, you know, conditions and opportunities and shutdowns and weather events and natural disturbance and all these other things. Just making sure that we're using that on a daily basis and it becomes part of what you do every day. And it would be a shame to buy a report to put it on a shelf just to fill a hole. We have an actionable system with our vulnerability assessment that we have specific items that we're acting on, and we depend on other people within our system itself that are on the land and on the FMA as well.
How often do you have to revisit the assessment? How often do you have to go through the process to keep it current?
Well, we're currently doing that as we speak. This is actually our first redo. And what we're doing this time is we're involving a wider breadth of staff members, especially our younger staff, because we've realized that they're going to be here for the long term. And I'm still involved in it. And I've been around for 30 plus years, but we have staff members who've only been here for a couple of years. And they're finding it very valuable to look at their future in forestry, to be able to contribute to that at a very early stage.
Mm. So it sounds like you're updating now, but the first one you started 10 years ago. You don't have to do it every year is sort of my question. Sherry, you want to come in there?
No, you don't do it every year, but what we do is through the planning and mainstreaming process and implementation, when we get to that stage, there are pieces that they're actually actioning every year and reporting on and collecting information. So it's a living process. It becomes part of what you do. You're not stepping away from it. Like, we started work on this in 2015. We sort of wrapped up and made our way through the whole process by 2018 and continued on with. Then you sort of focus on the priority areas. So you're never walking away from it, but now we're coming back to it at this stage because with companies in Saskatchewan, for example, that have to do a 20-year forest management plan, they renew every 10 years. And so Mystic is also in renewal for their 20-year forest management plan, which is where they were at when we started this for their last one. So it actually aligns itself really well to come back and sort of take a look at all the pieces and update it. So it's nowhere near as involved and will take as long as it took us originally. Hey, Kevin. But we've learned a lot. And so it's really not, once you build it, as long as you build in those milestones, those targets, those things as you're going through, when you come back and do a more comprehensive renewal, it's still not like a huge output.
I feel that the vulnerability assessment is a great tool to give you your priorities. So those priorities need to be addressed in your FMP to make sure that they stay alive. And you have an obligation to do something with those either annually or every 5 years or whatever period you take, depending upon what it is. Usually it's annually. If it's in the FMP, that's going to be recorded in our annual report as well. So you're going to have those, you know, we're going to be looking at those items on an annual basis that have been selected from the FMP and the vulnerability assessment, along with the tactics spreadsheet that we've developed just last year. So in order to keep all these things alive with, you know, and there are obligations with the climate change and vulnerability, that's the way to do it.
Mm. And I'm assuming, just asking for a friend, when you say FMP, you mean Forest Management Plan?
Yes.
Okay. Not all of us are foresters.
Yeah. And we have a 20-year forest management plan, which is updated every 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'd like to close this off with just a piece of tangible advice or key takeaways. If you were to give something to the listeners of this podcast, off of which many luckily are FSC certificate holders and forest managers or highly involved in the FSC system, if you were to give them like one key lesson that they should take away on vulnerability assessments, what should it be?
I would say that a well-done vulnerability assessment, it's going to help you maintain your forest productivity. And that's what it all comes down to. We want to ensure that we have healthy and productive forests going forward. And all of these things within that system, that's really what it comes down to, along with ensuring that all of our other forest users are pleased or are being included in the collection of this information, including Indigenous peoples across the land base, and in ensuring that their knowledge is going to be part of that and that they are rights holders. And we have specific obligations to them to ensure that climate is kind of an outlier, but they are included in that. We put our boots on every day, no matter whether it's a good day or a bad one. And climate is something that we receive, right? And we have to be prepared to deal with it in the best way possible. And the assessment does that. And I'm hoping that FSC will be able to implement some indicators into the standard and for everybody to follow. I believe in FSC and the process and the people and the approach. So it's easy for me to speak positively about the FSC itself.
I agree with Kevin on all those parts. I think, you know, too, from the broader picture, it helps give us tools that we can demonstrate accountability to the public, to different folks out there on the land base. It also gives us tools to be able to advocate on behalf of us as forest practitioners, but also even on behalf of what's actually happening out there on the land base. I've had the experience in working in provincial and federal government, and you work in these spaces, but often very disconnected from the landscape itself. And being out there, all of these folks that are out there working on the land base day to day, and the stakeholders being part of this with this process, it really gives invaluable insight into what's really happening. That's why I like working in this space, because growing up in the forest sector and working at seeing different things, there's always been this huge gap, between science and actual management and applicability on the ground, and then feeding that into the policy end of things, whether that's certification or provincial or federal policy. And I still see that out there, very prevalent. But I think, you know, in some spaces, we're starting to narrow that a bit. We have a long way to go in it. But I do think that this is a great vehicle for being able to continue to advance those things and making sure, like, consumers, right? They help keep this machine running, and you want to make consumers more aware that we're actually being sustainable. Part of sustainability is managing for these changes that are happening out there, whether they're cumulative impacts or climate change, whatever we're facing, we've got to be able to manage for them to practice sustainability and to have this resource there for multiple uses out there on the landscape. Kevin knows I'm very passionate about this stuff, and sometimes we feel like we bang our heads against the wall, but then we make those steps forward and we get to do this great work with great folks out there. So it helps keep you going in this space.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Forest for the Future. A big thank you to both Sherry and to Kevin for bringing their experience and insights on climate vulnerability assessments. To me, it really sounds like embedding processes like this would not only provide FSC certificate holders with tangible indicators, which can assure consumers and the public about their actions to ensure climate adaption, but that it would also provide forest owners themselves with a set of tools to make those difficult day-to-day decisions on where do we prioritize money and how do we have enough time to adapt as much as possible. And lastly, if implementing this into FSC could help make climate policy more informed and lessen the gap between science and research and the on-the-ground reality, what's not to like? In the final episode of the series, we will turn to managing forests for climate impacts, looking at high-profile challenges like wildfire and how concepts such as forest resilience, forest health, and indigenous stewardships are evolving in a changing climate. Thank you for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to Forest of the Future wherever you get your podcasts. I am Laura Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.